On behalf of the Miller Center for Public Affairs, I'm pleased to welcome you to a rotunda lecture with Lou Cannon of the Washington Post. Charles McDowell said recently that perhaps columnists had reached the point of diminishing returns because increasingly they seem to be answering one another rather than addressing the subject. Lou Cannon is a notable exception to that trend, if it is a trend. He best describes, I think, in one reaction to a review, the purpose of his columns. One reviewer had in what he called an exceptional generous review of Ronnie and Jesse, his book on Ronald Reagan and Jesse Unruh, had referred to the deeper contest that underlies all political competition. And Cannon wrote in that connection, "It is to this contest that my interest is addressed. I care a good deal, or I think I do, about our political system, and my intention is to write books that contribute to the understanding of that system and to those who inhabit it." That's a point of reference and an objective that has inspired his writings from the days in which, for the San Jose Mercury News, he covered the state capitol in California and Ronald Reagan, to his current writings on the president, Ronald Reagan. More than he knows, those of us who follow the presidency and follow politics in general draw upon his writings as a source of understanding of the political system. And perhaps this can be accounted for by the fact that his own formation and his own career was broader than that of most writers. He was a truck driver for 2 years after college. He wrote for three smaller papers in the first 3 years of his career. He was a copy editor before becoming bureau chief in Sacramento for the San Jose paper. And similarly, in his writings, there is a thrust that political scientists could well do themselves proud in imitating to try to understand the nature and the functioning of the political system. It's an honor for the Miller Center and quite appropriate in this place that we listen to and after the presentation discuss with Lou Cannon the topic Ronald Reagan at the Crossroads. Mr. Cannon.
Thank you for that very generous introduction, Ken. It's pretty much the way I wrote it. And thank you to Bill Miller for being able to be here with your communication students. This is a swell place to be at. I often start speeches with a story that stayed with me from the 72 campaign of Sergeant Shriver. You remember Sarge. He was McGovern's second choice for vice president. And, you know, politicians are always, no matter where they are, you put them out in the middle of that snow, and they've got two people to talk to, and they'll say, "It's great to be here." And so Sarge got up in this little town in Texas where there was supposed to be a big crowd, and there wasn't. There were like three or four rows of people here. Got a little peach box podium, looks out at this little crowd, and he says, "I'm great to be here." It is great to be here. This is the most wonderful place in the world to give a speech. And those of us who are in the reporting business, when we like to get pegs in our stories, historic events. We were with Ronald Reagan last week in Grenada, and we asked him, the reporters in the pool did, about the medical school. They went from point to point in the island where the U.S. troops had been in that little war, and of course one of the high interest points of the trip is the St. George's Medical School, where there were 800 American students who were rescued by our troops in this invasion. There, I've said it both ways. I've given the Reagan people rescue, and I've given the rest of us invasion. But in any case, they get to the medical school, and the press secretary, Larry Speaks, is not with him this day. He's attending a funeral in Mississippi. So Reagan is sort of on his own, and they're letting him, as a result, answer many more questions than he usually is able to answer at these picture-taking sessions known as photo opportunities. And so they say, the reporters in the pool, what do you think about being here at the medical school, Mr. President, thinking they will get some historic reply about how wonderful it is to be at the site where 800 American students were rescued, as he said in his speech. And Reagan looks at this a little wistfully, and he says, that's a nice-looking place. He says, it sort of reminds me of California. And that was it. It wasn't in my story. It probably won't be in your news magazine because none of us knew what to make of it. I'm gonna talk about Reagan at the crossroads in kind of two ways. I'm gonna talk about him as a president in the sixth year of his presidency, and I want to talk about the way he communicates. One is tempted to say that Reagan is always at the crossroads in the way he communicates, because he is at one time the most gifted television political communicator of our age, and he's also the regular supplier of kinds of remarks that appear to be gaffes or that are gaffes or sort of absent-minded witticisms that keep me with a store of what I call Reaganisms of the week to write every week. I don't think that the two things are as unrelated as people think, the great communicator and the gaffes. But first, I want to talk about where he stands in his policy. Recently, I wrote an article for the Outlook section of the Post that I began with a dire quote of all of the things that faced Ronald Reagan. All of the problems he was going to have with the budget, all the problems he was going to have with taxes, all the problems he was going to have in foreign policy. And the thrust of the piece was that finally all of the conflicting nature of Reagan's promises, particularly the promises to both raise the military spending to a level that he finds acceptable, cut taxes while balancing the budget, remember when that was a promise, or reducing the deficit, when all these things were going to come home to roost. And I quoted from this, and it looked like a very compelling account of the problems facing the president, and indeed it was, except it was written a year ago, at the beginning of 1985, when most of us were not confidently counting Reagan out, but saying really that the problems and contradictions of his presidency had come home to roost. I gave speeches then on Reagan at the crossroads, too. This year, I maintain he really is there. He has actually some real opportunities this year, and I think that he also has the chance that his presidency is going to be seen as a popular time of good feeling, much as Eisenhower's presidency was, but with not as a period of real accomplishment, that his presidency will be marked in the history books as an interlude rather than as the new direction which he fondly believes it will be. I think we're going to know the answer to several of these questions at the end of the year. In foreign policy, I think that the current situation in the Philippines, even though Reagan put his foot in his own policy a week ago by his sort of offhand reference, first in a interview with the Post and then in a national press conference about there being fraud on both sides, I think that the Philippines actually does mark a new era in American policy in Asia, a new era of realism. This was the time that the CIA did not take information from the government on, about how well everything was going, or from official sources. This was the time when the military argued early, find another horse. This was the time when a conservative senator was sent out to tell Marcos that that he had to change his ways. And while all of these things did not were not quite conscious in the sense that we knew what the ending was going to be, we knew at least that the beginning was different. There was an attitude of realism toward despots, which you also see in the providing of the plane for Mr. Duvalier, that is a welcome feature, a welcome realism of our foreign policy. For those of you who think, as I do, that the Central America policy is fraught with problem, there's also some kind of welcome news there. The welcome news was that last year the president very realistically conceded that he could not get any military aid for the rebels that he describes as freedom fighters and that the Sandinistas call Contras, and opted for what was little more than band-aids and blankets and food, as a result of which that war is now almost at an end. I think it is salutary and interesting that it is the friends of these freedom fighters in the Congress who are now worried that Ronald Reagan has become some kind of a wimp, and who are writing him letters entreating him to change his policy. In other words, I think that despite the rhetoric of the president's October 25th speech at the United Nations, that there is evidence of a kind of realism, a pragmatism, even, to use that word so distrusted by some of Reagan's conservative supporters, evident in the White House. I think you're also going to see that in domestic policy. Let me step back for a minute and say that with Reagan, the reason that Reagan is hard to understand, I believe, as a biographer of him, and the reason that he continually confounds his critics, dismays his supporters at times, the reason he is still interesting to us, still surprising to us, lie in contradictory impulses of his character. I guess I'm taking as a given that he has this optimism, this spirit of Americanism, this forward-lookingness that makes him a young old man. But other people have this, and they're not quite as contradictory as Reagan. And one of the paradoxes of Reagan is that here is a person who proclaims there are simple answers, there just aren't easy ones, who is derided as simplistic, who is in fact very contradictory and complex. And the contradictory impulses in Reagan are between his ideology, his beliefs, and between his tendency to compromise, to take what he can get, to do what his first political idol, Franklin Roosevelt, did, perhaps with more supreme effectiveness than anybody who ever inhabited the White House. Reagan is never completely satisfying nor completely understandable because he is at once an ideologue and a pragmatist. And you see this in all sorts of ways. When I started, I've written two books on Ronald Reagan. When I wrote the second book, I thought that I had a sort of running start. You know, I was wrong about everything about this book. I thought it would be, the first book had been easy. I thought this would be easier. It was much harder. I thought that I didn't have to deal with the boyhood, the early years of Reagan, because I had already done this. I found in talking to other biographers that most biographers have trouble with the log cabin phase of their hero's life, that they, you know, it turns out when you get right down to it that everybody had a mother and a father, and that everybody from the most famous president in the United States to the local axe murderer, you know, had somebody who said, "I never knew that Johnny was destined for greatness." And that there is, the other thing you find out is if you go and you have the opportunity to interview people in the same town in Dixon, Illinois, as I did in 1968 and then again in 1980, the number of people who got to know Ronald Reagan between 1968 and 1980 when he was growing up is absolutely remarkable. I mean, thousands of people. And so you find you want to get through these chapters. But I found I didn't know Ronald Reagan at all. And that to understand him, or to try to understand him as president, I had to try to understand his character, because Ronald Reagan decides things from the heart. Example, on taxes, which is the issue, not military spending. Taxes is the issue in which Ronald Reagan is most ideological and least compromising. And why is that? It's because, it isn't because he was waylaid by Jack Kemp and, you know, brainwashed in a seminar with Supply Siders somewhere. It's because Ronald Reagan grew up poor and made a lot of money in the late 40s on the strength of a contract that had been signed for him on a film before he went into the service. The film was King's Row. He comes out, he is making lots of money at the time that the marginal tax rate in the United States is 90% and individuals can't income tax average. And Ronald Reagan goes around, he's a liberal Democrat, mind you, he's not a conservative, and he's saying to people, we've got to have a human depreciation allowance like they have for the oil companies. Well, as he said once to a friend, it wasn't an idea that caught on, but it is something that has always stayed with him. Taxes for him are an evil. He loathes them. So if you want to understand Reagan, you have to understand Reagan presidency, you have to understand Reagan. And I found out in doing the second book about him that the key always to Reagan, and which is why I think people care about him, is the key to what goes on in his gut. Now, one of the other experiences that Ronald Reagan had was that he was a negotiator for the Screen Actors Guild for several years. He led them in their what was then their only successful strike. I think it might have been their only strike. He was a very good negotiator. He believes that he lost some roles that he would have had because producers got sore at him. I know negotiators for the American Newspaper Guild who think they didn't advance in their newspapers as well because they think publishers got sore at them too. And there's no way to, maybe he's right, there's no way to prove that. But Ronald Reagan told me something once that I have never forgotten in writing about it. And he said, the purpose of a negotiation is to get an agreement. And I've been in my head every time I write an arms control story, every time I was told by various of his stalwart supporters in the first term that he would never meet with a Soviet leader, much less make a serious arms control proposal. And that what Reagan does is that he negotiates. He negotiates and he compromises at the margins. This is the year when I think we can truly say that Reagan is at the crossroads, because this is the year that the ideologue and the negotiator are going to be most at war with one another. For Reagan to be a success in terms of the federal budget, for him to continue the economy on its growth path, and I think I have to give Reagan a little on the economy. He says we don't call it Reagan economics anymore during the recovery, and it's true, we don't. We called it Reagan economics mostly during the recession. But that isn't going to help him if there's another recession. People say that Reagan's popularity, like Eisenhower's, wasn't connected to his policies. They haven't looked at the polls. The two low points that both Reagan and Eisenhower have in their presidencies happen to coincide with the the lowest points of the economy in those presidencies and the greatest unemployment. And while Ronald Reagan will always be more popular in his policies, he will not, it isn't an automatic given. Our polls, as Barry Sussman, our pollster, likes to say, don't show the Teflon. There is an intimate connection between the economy and the way Ronald Reagan is received. And if you accept the analysis, which I do, that unless there is some effort made at deficit reduction this year, not a balanced budget, I don't need a balanced budget, but we do need some sign that the deficit is going in the other direction, that this is going to show up in the markets, that it's going to show up in the economy, that Reagan's recovery would be jeopardized. This means that he has to take this whole melange of issues, the tax increase that is there waiting to be enacted. If Ronald Reagan were to whisper tax increase to one senator of the United States of either party, a tax increase would be headed to him, you know, within a week. Some kind of restraints in the defense budget, which they're hoping to get help from the Packard Commission on next week, and some kind of domestic spending. Ronald Reagan can make his call for domestic spending cuts stick if he's willing to do some of the things he's asked to do. So what you have you've got all of these things coming together this year. I think they're going to come together late in the year because the Supreme Court today agreed to review Graham Rudman. They're not expected to decide until July. You don't know very much about what this Congress will do, but one thing you know is it won't make a decision before it has to, because it's like other Congresses. So that this probably means a decision that will be made in the fall in an election that will determine whether or not the Republicans control the Senate. I think that Ronald Reagan will run out of running room. A lot of people have been predicting it since he first announced for office in California in 66. You know, someday they'll be right. I used in Bill's class a while ago in answer to a question who was asking me, there was a question about a story that said that Marcos had fled a little premature, and I told the story of when John Scali, who was a very fine reporter for ABC, but when he prematurely reported that Franco had died during the Nixon administration, we said at the White House, we said John wasn't wrong, he just broke the embargo. Well, the embargo, at some point, it's going to be true that Ronald Reagan is run out of negotiating room and is a lame duck. But I'm not going to bet the mortgage that's going to be this year. Let me just briefly, before I take your questions, which I'd like to do, talk about Reagan as communicator and what I think he's been able to achieve and I guess what he hasn't. First of all, I agree with my friend Mark Shields, who says that the word great communicator is used by Reagan's critics as a put-down and as a way for them not to understand Reagan. That Reagan succeeds, Mark believes, because he, and so do I, because he has values, because he stands for something, because he has a strong agenda that people can relate to. And even in our very, very early polls, I think the first poll we did as Reagan as president, it showed that there were a number of people who thought that Reagan was a very strong leader, even who had great doubts about where he was leading us. I'd be happy to, I've been recorded on all sides of the question of whether Reagan is a strong leader or not, but I think he has problems this year and he has problems with leadership in the White House in particular. But the fact is that Reagan has always managed to project some kind of image of leadership and to understand that this is related, to the way one governs. Reagan knows, Reagan will talk about overexposure, which is one reason that he limits not only his press conferences, but carefully picks his speeches and picks the spots where he is televised. Reagan understands that there is a different impact when you see something than when you hear it or when you read it, which is why Ronald Reagan, who signed as governor of California the most permissive abortion bill in the history of the United States, when he appears with his Right to Life friends, he does not appear with them on the same platform. He addresses them electronically, so that what you see is the voiceover of the commentator describing what Ronald Reagan has said, and that has a different sort of impact. Ronald Reagan will say sometimes when a take is taken of him, when he's doing a speech or a debate or something, he'll say, that wasn't right, let's do it again, if it's a tape take. He has a sense, in other words, of what he is doing and why he is doing it, and that's very important to his success, but it isn't the reason for his success. Now, let us take the gaffes and the lines that have made, they've given those of us who cover the White House regularly something to look forward to, and many of my friends will say, there's your Reaganism of the week, and Reagan will say these wonderful things. During the first term, they had what they call the Deaver Rule, named after Mike Deaver, which came about because Reagan would answer questions during picture-taking sessions that they call photo opportunities. I have never seen this described in precisely what I think is the right way, so permit me to do it. The problem with Reagan is not that he doesn't want to answer questions. The problem with Reagan is that he does. He loves to answer questions. He wants to answer your question. He wants to answer every reporter's question. He is a courteous person. And he wants to answer the question whether or not he has the information with which to answer it, which is the source of the problem. So Mike thought of this rule. He hated it to be called the Deaver Rule, and knowing that, we all call it that. And I hope I do for some long time, even though Mike's gone now, making money. But the notion was that when you would go in and take a picture of the president, and he's sitting there with the prime minister of the Republic of Ishmael, that you would not then pounce upon the president and say, what do you think about, Tip O'Neill yesterday saying you were an idiot, Mr. President, or how are you going to handle the problem of IMF, which then poses the problem that he's got to know what IMF is. He's got to know what the reporter has in his mind. He's got to respond to the question. So very early in the presidency, in something that is really a neglected chapter for those who investigate communications, the correspondents at the White House, the television correspondents, all said, to hell with this, we're going to ask the president what we want to ask of in there, like we did with other presidents. Other presidents would just say, no comment, I won't answer your question. You know, I saw Carter during a session where he looked like he was the prisoner of war, supposed to give his name, rank, and serial number. Well, Carter was an especially uncommunicative prisoner of war. And Reagan could be too, but Reagan wasn't willing to do it. And the correspondents were very tough about this, and not one of their bureaus backed them up. You see, the threat was you wouldn't get in to get your pictures if you persisted in asking these questions on other subjects, and television lives by pictures. So the Deaver Rule applied. But Reagan, thank God, would sometimes forget the Deaver Rule or ignore it, and always ignore it if there was something he wanted to say. And one day, he was supposed to say, his answer was supposed to be, I don't take questions at photo opportunities. And one day he absentmindedly said, I don't take questions at news conferences. last week at Grenada, Sam Donaldson confronts Reagan, who is sort of, speaksless here and in need of him, and says, you're here at the scene of your greatest military adventure. How does it feel to be here at your greatest? And Reagan said, I didn't fire a shot. Damn good answer, I thought. I thought one of the best answers I've ever heard a president or politician give in any circumstance. It was self-deprecating. It was saying, look, he gives a speech. He said, we lost 19 people there. There was 45 killed in Grenada. The Cubans lost more than 50 killed. Reagan is often accused of being cinematic but he knows the difference between real gore. And that's what that answer said. Almost any other answer would have got him into trouble, I think. You know, how it's wonderful to be here in Grenada, which we liberated from. He didn't do that. And lots of the Reaganisms, I get people, I have only one criteria for Reaganism, which is that it should be evocative. And if it makes people laugh, that's good too. And I don't care whether it makes Reagan look good or look bad, or none of that bothers me. But I get criticisms all the time. I get people who, sometimes even from people who give them to me, who say, well, why do you use those lines about the president? And I said, you look back at them, and you'll find that a number of those lines serve the purposes of the great communicator well. Why did they serve his purpose? Because they make him seem like one of us. He talks in ordinary people terms. He makes jokes about himself. He puts himself down. For those of you who, like I, was raised in a family of Democrats, we knew that it was the Democratic Party. It wasn't the Democrat Party, the way the Republicans always said it. Watch Ronald Reagan. He says the Democratic Party. He was one of us too. And in this sense of understanding that the real effectiveness as a communicator, the real effectiveness of rhetoric, is to be able to put yourself in the shoes of the person to whom you're speaking, and to elevate or uplift or reach or move him. Reagan is truly the great communicator. And having said that, I still think he's in for a tough year. And one of these years, I'm going to be right.
Acknowledge that the one person most responsible for the invitation to Mr. Cannon is the chairman of the Department of Rhetoric and Communication, who sometime during our discussion may want to ask a question. Who'd like now to ask the first question?
Yes, Jeff Keller.
A couple of weeks back, President Reagan made an interesting response when he was asked an if question. He said that some hypothetical scenario was stated, and the question was, what would you do if, Mr. President? And he said, I don't answer what if questions. And he said he got that from Franklin Roosevelt. Do you think he's stuck to that, and do you think that's a good policy for him to keep to?
I think he actually, did everybody hear the question? The question was that Reagan, it was at his news conference, he was asked a hypothetical question. He said, I don't answer if questions. And I think he said, and he attributed that to Franklin Roosevelt, and he said he was like a lot of answers, a lot of Reagan's answers, or a lot of our answers, I suppose, too, are right for the first two sentences. And it's the third sentence you add that gets you into trouble. And he says, and Roosevelt never departed from that, which, of course, is not true. No, I think that that's a sort of the question was, is this good for Reagan to do this? I think that that was kind of a rhetorical embellishment. No one likes to answer hypothetical questions. Reagan is well advised not to answer, because if you look at the hypothetical questions he answers, you wind up in the jungles of Central America or somewhere where he neither wants to be, nor do we. But like other people who have said that, he answers hypothetical questions when it suits his purpose. While no immediate example springs to mind, there are several occasions where Reagan has in fact taken a hypothetical question and answered it. A lot of times in foreign policy, I think it is necessary for any president to say, to take that view, though. You can't, if you say, what if Gaddafi, attacks, has a terrorist attack in America, what do you do? Those are the kinds of questions that you're not supposed to answer, it seems to me, from the presidential podium.
What will be the effect of the space shuttle fiasco on Mr. Reagan?
I think the space shuttle I don't know whether we know whether there's more to it than we know now. Judging from what we know now, which appears to be that people ignored warnings from this company that and launched when they shouldn't have, it seems to me that this is not going to come back particularly as a White House problem, because the administration did something that I think was very wise, although I don't think they realized how wise it was when this first happened. You remember the first idea was that NASA was going to investigate itself, and the White House appointed this commission, and they did it, I think, not because they thought there was anything wrong. I think Reagan was described to be as quite shocked when he heard this, but because they thought that it would give the appearance of impropriety. Now I think it's very good that they've done it. I think that the problem is going to be that the White House or the administration is going to be particularly blamed for this tragedy, which happens in bureaucracy, it happens in organizations. But I think that the extent of the problem is going to make it much more difficult than anybody originally thought, who favors that manned space program as the president does, to get it going again. And I think that there will be a real concern probably in 1987 that when we're scheduling launches again, that are we protecting the people who are going to go on those launches? And it seems to me that's where the administration is going to have some difficult decisions to make. I believe that the president is going to be very, very strong for pressing for continuation of the manned spaceflight program, despite what this inquiry has shown. And my guess is that he would be able to get public support and congressional support for that. Yes, sir.
I'd like to know, what important changes would you say are important in terms of Reagan's relationship to some of his staff, especially, say, you know, Weinberger, Reagan, Casey, Schultz, Stockman? I'm especially interested in the relationship between, say, you know, taking Stockman to the woodshed as opposed to, you see, like, people who have, like, his ear, you know, like, you look in the staff meeting and you'll see Weinberger there, you know, next to Reagan, you know, that kind of proximity. How do you see that change in importance?
The question is about Reagan's relationships with his staff and cabinet members. I see a very important change occurring in the Reagan administration in this term. In the first term, you had the first term is an illustration of why presidencies are really run by people. They're not the sum of a bunch of organization charts. If you were described the way the White House worked in the first term, and I did, it sounds like you're describing a pattern of that's totally chaotic. You had Baker and Meese and Deaver and Stockman and pitted off against Reagan, and Stockman pitted off against Weinberger, and the White House staff pitted off against Haig, you know, whom they and Haig thinking that everybody was out to get him, and they were, but he didn't realize that he was one of those who was out to get him, and you had this absolute sort of frenzy, and it was very, very good for the presidency, and very good for this president, and therefore good for the country, because there was all sorts of viewpoints and ideas that were brought to the attention of Ronald Reagan. Helen Caldicott, the peace activist, spent 2 hours one day in the office with Reagan because I forget it was Marine or Patty or somebody, I think it was Marine, thought it was a good idea and called Deaver, and Deaver arranged it. And Mike Deaver, who was not a substantive person in terms of any policy, was very good in terms of Reagan, and that he knew that Reagan needed to be exposed to a whole number of ideas. And Pat Buchanan told me about, oh, I guess the middle of 86, that when he went in there, he went in the White House, and he had a lot of ideas that didn't turn out to be true about what his role would be in there, but he contrasted the preparing of Reagan for a press conference with the preparing of Nixon for me. Nixon wanted everything on paper. I restrained the impulse to say too much, but he wanted everything on paper. He wanted all of his stuff prepared for him, had this tremendous command of facts, and he wanted it all funneled through one or two people, and they would come, and Nixon would do this preparation. Reagan assembled 13 people in the family theater, said Buchanan. It was crazy, you know. Everybody's asking this question and that, and standing up and putting this idea to him and other. That's the way Ronald Reagan learns. Ronald Reagan has not learned from briefing papers. He doesn't have the command of facts that a Nixon or Carter has, but he has a much better people sense than either of them had. And so now he has a nice corporate hierarchical structure, which it all comes funneled to him through Donald Regan. And I think that is not good for Reagan. I mean, apart from the substance of Regan's ideas, I think that Regan does present different sides. I think he's an honest broker, but it's all distilled. And Reagan gets stuff from people. His model in that is FDR. I mean, FDR insisted on having all of these viewpoints from all sides, and Reagan had a lot of that in his first term. He has much less of it now. Stockman was an independent force. Jim Miller is not. He's basically a regulator. He's a good guy, but he's not. Does not have a powerful command of the budget in mathematical and terms, really, more than numbers terms that Stockman had. And so you're down to a very small section of advisors. Cap Weinberger is more rigid than he was, in my view. You're down to a small group of people. I question whether Reagan is getting the broad range of opinions on some things that he needs, and I think that's a problem for him. Not an insurmountable problem. I mean, he's got Schultz, he's got people with ideas around him, but it's much more constricted than it was in the first term. Yes, this gentleman back here, I hope I'm getting everybody here. Do you want to see? Yes.
What you mentioned about the Reagan administration's tendency toward more realism in foreign policy, could you expand on that in relation to Central America? And secondly, can you tell me what, in your opinion, are his chances of getting additional funding for cultures post the Nicaraguan government?
Well, I think Central America is the... maybe it's just the question that next to arms control interests me the most in this administration. I think Central America is relative to other foreign policy questions. I said that on the domestic issue in which I thought Reagan was most ideological was taxes. The foreign policy issue in which I think he's most ideological is Nicaragua. The problem of understanding Reagan's views on it is that people who either applaud or detract from him tend to talk about Reagan's anti-communism, the way Reagan deals with issues involving a communist presence. And they do that as if he had a uniform approach. And in fact, he doesn't. He's much more pragmatic in dealing with the Soviet Union on superpower questions than he is, it seems to me, in Central America. Reagan clearly feels that there is a very big difference between communism in Asia or communism in Africa, despite the sort of squiring around of Zavimbi the other week, and communism seen in his terms in Central America. Ronald Reagan would have been able to have gotten us out of Vietnam, I think, much more readily than President Nixon did. But he really is sort of concerned with the the dilemma posed by one of his aides is we don't want another Vietnam, but we don't want another Cuba. In a sense, I argue this, that Reagan's, in my column this morning, I argue that Reagan's defense budget is imperiled by his success in convincing people that we're spending that much more in defense. I think his Nicaragua policy is imperiled by the success of his El Salvador policy. The fact is that Duarte is doing a good job. Duarte would have been a guy that any liberal Democrat in this country would have been happy to have brought to power in Nicaragua. The real reason, the real concern, the real cutting edge of our involvement was the concern of what would happen in El Salvador. And that is not a very big concern right now. As a result, it's going to be very hard, I think, to persuade the Congress to do more for the Contras. I think the Contras are in, I'm persuaded by what I've been seen and been told, that the Contras are in very bad shape militarily. And I think that you're going to see this year a much more confrontational approach in Central America, even while you compromise differences on other issues, because I think that the Republican leadership in the House, Trent Lott, Dick Cheney, even Bob Michael, are going to insist that there be some kind of up or down vote on military aid, because the Contras can't make it on the humanitarian aid. The Republicans argue that you're getting the Democrats off the hook. They can say they've done something, but in fact they're not doing anything. I think that there'll be a vote. I think that Reagan will lose the first round. One of the qualities of Reagan is that he's persistent, and I think he'll come back. I think it's probably in the fall you'll get something for the Contras, but militarily they're nowhere, and it's hard for me to see how this administration could get enough aid that it would even make them the kind of effective harassment force that the president envisions them to be. I think his policy is a loser on that issue, but I don't think he's going to give it up easily. That it would even make them the kind of effective harassment force that the president envisions them to be. I think his policy is a loser on that issue, but I don't think he's going to give it up easily. I don't know how to. The lady over there had a question, or at some point I don't. I'm. Ken, you want to help me out here? I don't. I just.
You had a question.
You were talking about Reagan. You said you were giving speeches last year at this time. Yeah. Across your
board. Yeah.
How much erosion of his support in Congress have you seen over the last year?
Well, I think Reagan is, in some ways, I think he's better off on some issues in Congress than he was. I think probably Reagan is ahead of the game on certain kinds of foreign policy issues. I think that the summit, whether it was a success or not, there are a lot of stories that have depicted the summit as a great success, and others that as just sound and fury signifying nothing. But we're not going to know whether the summit was a success until the next summit, or maybe not until the summit after that. And I think that Reagan does have a bipartisan support for some kind of framework of arms control. I think there's a real chance for a medium-range missile and INF agreement this year. I think he's got more support in Congress than he had a year ago at this time, because most people didn't think the summit would ever come off. Where I think he's lost support is on the tax issue. I think that more and more Republicans have looked at the alternatives facing them. They're up for election this year, 20 some of them in the Senate, all of them in the House, and most of them simply do not want to face the choice of being depicted as being soft on defense because they're cutting defense, or having to cut favored domestic programs, and they're turning, they really want some kind of tax increase as a way out. I think that unless Reagan grasps how important this is to his party, he faces a very difficult time in the fall, because these guys can't go out there and campaign very effectively on. I fought to get this bill through that the president vetoed, which we couldn't override. That's not much of a platform, and there's not the strength there to override vetoes. So I think that Congress is very, very upset and concerned and worried, and particularly the Republican leadership in the Senate, that they thought at this time last year that Reagan would, in their term, see the light, and he hasn't. But I don't think that has anything to do with, I think that has most to do with the election. I don't think that has much to do with whether it's the fifth year or the sixth year, other than the fact that this is a year when if you're a Republican, you've got to figure out a strategy to run with Reagan and away from him at the same time. Reagan went to Missouri the other week, spoke for, in this protectionist climate that exists there, spoke for free trade before 800 partisan Republicans, and as they say, you could hear the sentence and you could hear the pin drop. I was on deadline, so I wasn't in the room. I was in the press center listening to the speech, and you hear this long pause, which is the pause in which applause is given. It wasn't.
A comment on his apparent loss in capability to bring peace in the Middle East.
I think that in the Middle East, the administration's hopes were always kind of an illusion. I think we were counting almost entirely on getting Hussein to lever Arafat, and there just wasn't the leverage there. I mean, many of the policymakers at state were telling us, even as the president was saying that his Middle East peace plan was alive, that it really wasn't. I guess I think the administration has done poorly in that area, but I'm not sure what it is that they could do to succeed. I also have a feeling that Lebanon had some kind of a psychic burn in this administration, and that I do not detect, and it just may reflect my own levels of interest or the people that I talk to, but I don't detect a kind of burning desire as I do on the issues of Central America or on arms control, or even to some degree, because we're very worried about Mexico, even on third world economic problems, I don't detect that this administration really believes that there's going to be any real progress in the Middle East, and it seems to me they're just getting by. That if you were to say, what's the secret hope of the administration in the Middle East, is that the policy won't be any worse there when they leave. That may be very unfair, but I don't sense that's high on anybody's agenda. And there is one objective clue. The objective clue was the arms package for Jordan, which Reagan very much wants, not because I think he thinks that the arms package for Jordan is good, but he made a promise to Hussein, and Reagan takes his promises seriously. And they all talked Reagan out of that. You know, they withdrew that proposal. I mean, they didn't, now if you're going to try to talk Reagan out of contra aid, you're not going to be able to do that. But they didn't have to talk very hard on Jordan. And I just don't think there's much of a policy there.
Predecessors heard the epitaph of flip-flop. You used the word the Teflon in describing. To what extent do you think this is an accurate reflection of the actual character of the man? To what extent is it a creation of the press?
What?
Well, the contrast between the image of, say, Carter and Reagan. To what extent are both seeing the distillate that's come through the simple personal relationship with the press and the president?
That's a very good question. Let me try. First of all, I guess I would have to tell you that I think that there is, you can make a good case that Carter didn't flip-flop on a number of things, and you can make a case, as I've made here today, that Reagan is not Teflon, as Pat Schroeder, who coined that term, uses the word. He certainly isn't Teflon in the sense that the point I was trying to make, and maybe should have used our pollster Barry Sussman's words, is that if you're taking it literally, it says that things don't stick to him, and things do stick to him, and here's what happens when you have a recession. Nonetheless, I think that also conveys a certain a kind of symbolic truth. Carter did waffle at some critical issues in his presidency, which made people, at his campaign for that matter, which made people think of him in that way. And there are a number of things which Reagan has done which you would have thought would have sunk other politicians, which haven't sunk him. My nomination is the Lebanon adventure. I've used this quote before, but it applies probably. Stu Spencer, who is Reagan's advisor and a friend, was working for Ford in 76 when Bob Teeter, the Republican pollster, joined the campaign. They were out to beat Reagan, and they did, but not without some cost. And Stu said to Teeter, he says, "Let me tell you a couple of things about this guy, Bob." And the second thing that he said to him was, "He can walk away from something that no other politician could survive." And I think there is. So I think there is a sort of a rough sense. Now, after having said that, you know, we oversimplify. I mean, we in the press oversimplify. We do that because we don't have enough space or enough time or enough imagination or enough brains or something. And I oversimplify too. And I think we oversimplify too much about Reagan. But yes, both of those caricatures, in my view, have meaning. Yes, sir.
You mentioned in your speech how concerned the president is with his television image. I was a little curious as to, do you feel that there's a big contrast between his concern with that and his concern with his image in print media? Does he really get mad about the way he is portrayed sometimes in print media?
Reagan gets upset about being ridiculed. He doesn't like to be ridiculed. As far as I know, ridicule will bother him, and any criticism of Nancy will bother him. He doesn't get upset either, particularly on television or print, about a policy criticism. I mean, you can hammer his policy, and he's apt to sit back and say, "Well, the Democrats are having their day at it," or you know, "That's canon writing again," or something like that. But if somebody's putting him down personally, he doesn't like it. You know, rather than a policy. I mean, as long as you keep it on a policy thing, he's fine. And is he as sensitive to things in the print media? I think yes and no. He reacts to the same sorts of stuff, and he does read the morning papers, and he gets a digest of them. And I've seen those digests. They do not. They're not kind digests. They don't just give him the good news, but. But I think he is a creature of the television age, and he understands that a gaffe on television or a portrayal on television that would say you don't know what you're talking about has more impact. In other words, I don't think that he personally makes the distinction other than as a realistic political distinction, which I think is there. I think it's much worse to screw up on television than to do it in an interview with the Washington Post. Yes, sir.
How much influence do you think Reagan will have over the 1988 presidential race?
I think that Reagan will not have much influence in the 1988 presidential race at all, if you mean in terms of selecting candidates. But I think that in terms of his economic policies of the last year, whether we have tight money or not, which he's got to get a little help from the Federal Reserve Board, and on what assignments he gives his vice president, he could have a lot of impact, indirect impact. He can have enormous impact. His policies could have an impact. He cannot anoint. One of the great things about our system is that I like Ike didn't work as a slogan. I mean, it worked for Ike. It didn't work for the people who just liked him and who were the Republicans. You know, Roosevelt went out in 38 to purge 8 Democratic senators who had opposed his policy. He was 0-for-8. Ronald Reagan cannot anoint his successor. And I bet you he'd agree on that. Do you have a? No, there was somebody
one
back
last,
there.
Yeah.
Then you, sir. We'll take two.
The Supreme Court reduced Grandmother Hall, saying that impact is absolute intensity and hatred of taxes. You can that light the fire, and maybe you'll see the light. If we can't balance the budget of the law, maybe taxes are cheap.
Well, I think this. The Supreme Court, it's dangerous to predict what any court will do, as any lawyer knows, and I'm not a lawyer, and I know that much. I think the court's probably going to uphold the lower court decision, which simply has the effect of removing an automatic trigger. I think it helps Reagan. I think if the court upholds the decision, it's going to help Reagan. The real worry that the people in the White House had would be that Congress would go home and somebody else, this automatic something they call the sequester, would cut all of these make all these defense budget cuts. Without that provision, I think it's going to have to be negotiated, and I'd say it isn't going to affect Reagan's basic feeling about taxes, but it means that Reagan is going to negotiate without having this gun at his head, and I think he has the high ground. I think that the court has given Reagan an advantage over the Democrats. Hey, sir, the last question you had.
Two distinguishing Reagan policies in the external realm seem to be his uncompromising adherence to the Strategic Defense Initiative and his almost uncompromising opposition to the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. In a previous answer, you suggested that Mr. Reagan is not quite at the crossroads yet on matters of Nicaragua. Is he approaching the crossroads on matters of SDI?
That's a really good question, and it's one of the answer to which my editors would like me to find out. Let me make what we used to call in the police beat a confession. I don't know. I think that Reagan has a little running room on SDI too. It is interesting that the Soviets have dropped their insistence that the United States stop research and development of weapons in space, what they call space strike weapons, which is somewhat broader than SDI, but includes SDI, as a condition of negotiation on other types of arms control. The Soviets know damn well we're going to continue with research on that. They're researching on it too. SDI has succeeded, even if one doesn't think that's feasible or like the idea, in getting the Soviets to where they are now. At some point, it seems to me that the president is going to have to compromise, not scrap it, but say, we will agree not to deploy A, B, and C, and we will confine our research in those areas. Gorbachev has made it easy on him. He has not said what would be acceptable limits. At some times, like in the Time interview, he said research is fine. Other times he says, he's been as imprecise as Reagan. He seems that we should cease it entirely. I think that if they are able to get through some kind of an interim agreement limiting medium-range weapons in Europe, that Gorbachev would be in a position to say before the Moscow summit, in 1987, hey, we've gone, as Reagan phrased, you know, we've gone the extra mile on this, and now you have to make some concessions. Now, I'm not a Soviet expert. I don't know if he has the creativity and flexibility and the support of his system to be able to do that, then my guess would be Reagan runs into that particular wall, not in the sixth year, but in the seventh, in which case I can go somewhere else and give the speech, Reagan at the crossroads.
This surely is one of the finest lectures we've had.